Cool. All right. Since you guys did the interview last week, do you have anywhere you wanted to start or?
Yes, unfortunately, it
You can start with it. Let me pull it up. Give me a second. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so I think the answer to a little bit of this in the last interview, but what advice would you give to yourself if you were just starting your career? I think what I would say is, that's a hard question, actually. It's the, I don't know, this is gonna sound maybe a little cheesy, but to like give yourself like time and grace to sort of explore different topics or like learn things, but you don't always have to be an expert in everything right off of the bat. And to just like, if you find something interesting, to take time and actually spend time learning about it and working on it. And because I think some of the most interesting projects that I've ended up doing have resulted from sort of meeting someone and thinking, finding out like what they're working on is really interesting, and then working with them on something and sort of finding a collaboration. And so just like being like open to that, and then also just you don't have to be an expert in everything when you're first starting out. I think especially as a woman, you like need this to like feel like you have to prove yourself. But to like just let go of that feeling a little bit, because you learn a lot more when you recognize that you don't know everything and you ask questions.
I guess to that end, is there anything that you wish you'd also explored or any other avenues?
I think, well, you know, it's funny because you can only,
Or
you
you
know, really
wish you
come
had
to,
time to explore, I guess,
yeah,
too?
you really become an expert in like, you know, sort of one area, whereas like, I find so many things interesting that I, you know, it's like maybe just by chance that I met my graduate advisor and he studied snow, so I ended up in snow. Like I could have ended up doing something totally different. I just found someone that I worked well with and just loved what they were doing, and I ended up doing that as well. And so I feel like if there's any so many chances along like your sort of lifetime, like you could just branch out and end up having done something totally different. And so yeah, I think I imagine like, you know, different like sort of pathways where I could have done something totally different. I just ended up doing this, but and I like what I'm doing, but like maybe I could have done something else and it would also would have been great. So yeah, it's, I feel like once I picked my research topic, I really focused on that for a long time. And now I get a little more freedom to explore other things. And I'm like, well, this is interesting. This is interesting. So now I have the freedom to sort of to do that a little bit more. But I just really picked this one thing and felt for a long time I had to be the expert in that thing.
Do you have any advice for anyone that like doesn't happen upon finding an advisor right away, like struggling to find their passion or something, but they know they want to be in the field, especially for like, you know, women in the field too, and like
I hear so many stories from people recently out of grad school or in grad school that have bad advisors and their lives are miserable. Or alternatively, they have a really bad experience in graduate school and now they don't do science anymore because it just sort of like pushed them out. And so I would say if you know, if you really like give it a little bit of time because sometimes relationships take time to establish. But if you're a year into a program and you're like, this is not working for me, don't be afraid to switch. Don't be afraid to find someone that you work better with because graduate school is a lot of work and you don't want to like hate every moment that you're there. You want to feel like you're doing something useful with your time. And so my best advice to people is don't be afraid to stop the program if it's not working for them.
Makes sense.
So how do you think more women could be encouraged to pursue a career in STEM, and particularly in research? I think there's a couple things. The first one is maybe more systemic and a little bit harder to address, is just seeing more women in the field, because you can picture yourself, or you see other women that you can look up to, or be can mentor you, or you can just picture yourself in their shoes. That's the first kind of hurdle. And if you don't see that, then you say, like, oh, maybe this isn't the field for me. Maybe there aren't women experts, for whatever reason. Maybe just women aren't welcome in this field, or and then the other thing I think is easier to do now, which is just to be, not just women who are in the field, but everyone who's in the field, to be welcoming and supportive. And not to ever, I think what my graduate advisor did really well is just gender never was an issue. Never brought it up. It wasn't like, oh, you can't do this, woman, or something. It just like was not, it was like totally a non-issue. And I think that's how it should be for everyone. Everyone should be treated equal and welcomed. And I mean, everyone comes in with different strengths. It doesn't matter what your gender is. And so it's just like, well, like recognizing everyone's unique strengths and sort of finding what works best for them, independent of gender, and just making sure it's a welcoming environment for everyone. So it's sort of breaking down barriers and seeing yourself represented in the field, but also then just like feeling that you're welcome and able to grow within the field.
Do you think there's anything like in particular that Utah could do to encourage more involvement from women in the field? Or like encouraging women to pursue those degree?
Yeah, I think, if I am totally honest, I think Utah has some unique hurdles to deal with, based upon sort of religious backgrounds of the student body, and maybe assumptions that faculty or graduate advisors might have about women coming into their programs, about whether or not they're gonna like maintain careers in something, or if they're going to choose to be a mom, or and that shouldn't ever, I don't think that should ever come into the equation at all. Like, if you have a bright student that wants to study something, then that should be treated as a bright student who wants to study something. And so I think, I don't know how to address that here, but I've seen it in action. I've seen people making assumptions about students, would that they shouldn't be. And so, I mean, I think going back to what I was saying before is, if they can just, and it can be as simple as their marketing materials or individual department and how they advertise their programs show women in STEM roles, and make that a regular part of the visualization and recruiting techniques. So people aren't afraid to speak up and say, okay, I want to try out and have this research experience and see if it works for me, or I'm interested in chemistry, I see other women doing that, I feel comfortable going into that role. So I think just like sort of marketing and visualization and all that can have a big role. And so just making sure women are represented in those fields.
Yes.
Expanding on that, what impact do you see having a more equal and greater general representation in STEM fields and STEM careers would be?
We say that one more time.
What impact do you see in having more female representation and more women in STEM career fields?
Yeah, that is a good question. I mean, I think it just, I think men and women sometimes have different like life views, and it's just a diversity of perspectives ultimately. And it doesn't have to be even, male versus female. It can just be also backgrounds. Like, the more diversity of perspectives you have, the stronger science you end up getting. And everyone has their own unique life experience that allows them to think about problems in different ways. And so collaborating with people with a sort of a diverse background and a range of life experiences ultimately makes STEM stronger. And if you have just a bunch of old white guys working on something, then that is not, you're really missing out on opportunities. And that, so I think it's really just welcoming all perspectives and being open to all perspectives, and that will strengthen.
So.
Absolutely agree. Yeah. Okay, taking a pivot here, what is the worst thing about your job? Is there anything you wish you didn't have to do or that you struggle with your dream job?
Well, yeah, there are some things that I could critique about my job. I think once you are in a faculty role with a research component, your time gets split between teaching and research, and the emphasis, at least at the University of Utah, it's not the same everywhere, but the emphasis of the University of Utah is on research. But you're also really expected to be an excellent teacher. And so it can be a challenge to balance both of those things. And, you know, the saying is kind of goes like, you can do a lot of things, but do none of them well. So you like, you know, you sort of feel pulled in all these different directions. And I always want to be a good teacher and I want to be a good researcher, but that's a really challenging balance to have. And then also just the administrative work that comes along with research. A lot of just paperwork and budgets and spending and not the fun part of science, but it's the not. And that is something I could, if I never had to deal with it again, I would gladly let somebody else do it. That's probably the worst part of my job, but it kind of just comes along with managing research funding. Yeah.
And then oppositely, what's your favorite thing about your job right now? And what about your life? And what do you enjoy most about teaching and researching?
The favorite part of my job is advising students and getting to watch them sort of start a project, sort of get formulate ideas and then carry through on the project to the end and gain skills on how to actually approach something scientifically and sort of start thinking more critically about the world around them. And it doesn't even have to be, you know, they can gain those skills doing something snow or hydrology related and then take it elsewhere. And so it's, you know, frequently I spend the most time with my graduate students, but that can also go with undergrad projects as well. And it's just, I think it's really fun to watch students sort of grow and become more independent thinkers on their own and sort of take ownership of their own ideas or just become more confident in like doing research. That's the favorite part of my job. And then I think if I were to think about like more broadly being in this role, being a faculty person who does research and teaching, like you do end up working a lot, but you have a lot of flexibility in your schedule. And so you can, you know, I can like take time off to go climbing, or as long as I get, like, there's no, I don't really have a boss. I mean, I'm a department chair, but the only person who's really paying attention to me getting my work done is me. And so it gives me a lot of freedom. Or if it's like, you know, powder day, it's so that is really nice because it ultimately ends up being a lot of work. But there's a lot of flexibility when that work actually gets done. And I think that's what ultimately keeps me in this job is that flexibility.
So then I guess to kind of pivot more to like your research, I know I read through the transcripts from last time you said one of your favorite projects you done was the dust on snow research you did on like the Wasatch Front. And I guess kind of connected to that, do you think that's had like the most impact as far as, you know, helping forward this climate change, like be able to take action on climate change? Or like, is there another project that's been more impactful to kind of advise our politicians to work towards mitigating the effects of climate change and like reducing our footprint?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the dust on snow has the most immediate impact because it's something we can see. We watch the dust get emitted, we see it land on the snowpack, the snow is dirtier, and everyone can see it. And that means that if you can see it, it's easier to get people to take action. Whereas climate change is this more like nebulous thing that we only see the effects of. And so I think more broadly in my work, maybe something that will have a longer term impact is one of the things I study is snow albedo, or basically it comes back to dust and soot. It's how bright is the snow and how reflective is it? And snow is the brightest natural surface on Earth. And so the more snow cover we have every winter, the cooler our planet is. But as it warms, that snow, we get less and less snow and ice every year. And that exposes darker ocean water or soils, whatever is underneath that. And then we absorb more sunlight and it accelerates, it feeds back to climate warming. And so a lot of the work I do on like sort of the physics and optics of snow and snow albedo and improving the way that snow albedo is represented in models is probably ultimately going to have a bigger impact on how we model and understand the impacts of climate change. Doesn't necessarily have a bigger impact on policy because I feel like there's very little policy on climate change, whereas something local like the shrinking Great Salt Lake, it's very easy to take policy actions on that. So there's sort of two ways that I see policy is like impacting the hydrology or snow hydrology within a region, and that's more immediate, and then sort of longer term having an impact on climate science. And that might, and eventually over the long term might end up having a bigger impact, but it's a little more, it's a little more indirect, sort of like improving processes and models.
Yeah. I guess to that end, do you think, new graduate student coming in that wants to work on addressing climate change and do research that helps to avoid, accelerating it? Do you think you like encouraging them to work on, more national scale and like bigger picture things is a better idea, or localized, like finding local projects like the Great Salt Lake, that, might be more effective?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think both. I think both are needed and relevant. I think having an impact at the local scale that impacts your community where you live is really relevant. And obviously, some places really need local solutions to local problems. And every community also plays a part in bigger climate policy as well. So there's a role to be said about local. But then we also need people willing to take on this sort of grand challenge of bigger sort of federal policy. And even though the political climate is maybe not super supportive of that right now, I mean, if people just, can be intimidating, but if people give up and don't do it, then we'll never get anywhere. I think it's both. If a student was really interested in working on sort of the climate or like more like sort of regional to global scale and having an impact on policy at those scales, I would do everything I could to support them.
Thanks. Let's see. Sorry, we answered some of these questions last time. This is just kind of a more general section. And I guess, yeah, did you ever, or do you still feel any like imposter syndrome? And if so, like, how did you overcome it? Or how do you work towards overcoming it? How would you recommend or give advice to a student that feels like they are an imposter?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know that you ever grow out of imposter syndrome. Maybe some people do, or maybe some people never feel it in the first place. I don't know. I've always felt it. I think it fades a little bit over time as you just get a little bit more established or older, and it's still there, but you know, you're so busy working on your projects that you don't think about it as much. And then it comes kind of roaring back every time you go to a conference and you see what everyone is working on, and you're like, oh, what am I doing here? Like, do I belong here? Everyone's doing so cool, so much cool stuff. Like, and I think the advice that I give to myself and to students is, you know, and it comes back to the sort of diversity of views and ideas. Like, you could be working on a similar problem as someone else, and you're coming at it with a different viewpoint and different ideas, and to, you know, all the better for different people to be working on the same problem, because there could be multiple solutions or fixes to that problem. And so try to say, like, don't, you know, in a way it will always feel like competition in academia and research, but to not view it as competition, but as even like it's that similar research is supporting other research, because that's the whole point of science, is that you want to reach a consensus on something.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want different people working on the same topic, because you ultimately want to reach consensus. And a part of that is being able to recognize that when maybe you're doing something wrong, or sort of have this like incorrect hypothesis about something, and that can be challenging. But you have to be able to recognize it, because we're all sort of working towards the same goal of better understanding our Earth system a little bit better. But ultimately, I think I also try to tell people that, you know, listening to other people talk about their research is just like social media. They're going to present the best side of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to tell you about all the problems that they had or all the issues that they ran into. And so it's going to seem like this perfect, polished product, and you're going to panic and be like, I'm having such a hard time with this. Like, how is it so easy for them? And that's just like, I'm like, think about the way you present your research. You don't spend the first 10 minutes talking about all the issues that you had. It's sort of a polished product. And so I just encourage students to think about what goes into that polished product, and not to compare themselves to others. So it's easy advice to give, but it's not always easy advice to actually like take and implement. But I just always try to keep that in mind, even though it can be really hard to watch your colleagues present cool research and be like, oh, they're so much farther ahead than I am. Yeah.
Take that step back and be objective.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of going off that, and like conferences, what's been your experience like presenting at conferences? Was that first experience just like terrifying, or did you feel at ease the whole time?
No, the first experience was terrifying. I think I still can remember like my voice kind of like making this weird like wavy noise, because I like couldn't really, I don't know, I was so nervous. And then thinking about it while I was presenting, I was like, why do I sound so weird? And then it's like, that's like a feedback in your head. And I practiced a lot. And then for each talk after that, I practiced a lot until I just got a little bit more comfortable. And now when I give talks, I like, I don't really practice. It's just, I've done it so many times, but it's the same thing where it's all, like, some people are more comfortable talking in front of others and other people aren't. And it is a critical part. Going to conferences and presenting your research is a critical part of what we do. So whether or not it's like it's practice or like talking to yourself in the mirror or whatever, it's kind of something you have to find a way to get to be comfortable with. And sometimes that just means going through some uncomfortable experiences where you're really nervous. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Then kind of shifting topics a little bit. Did you ever notice like a shift in gender representation throughout the field, like throughout your career? And did you ever notice like a disparity in funding and how things were allocated, and you saw like all your male colleagues getting funding when you and other women weren't, or was that not as evident or gender noticed as much?
Yeah, I'll address the first question first. I think just now, so I've been doing this, I started graduate school in 2009, And I think just now we're sort of reaching a point where I can look around and see more. And you know, they're graduate students or early career, you know, but I can look around at conferences and there's many more women involved in snow science than there were when I started. And that's great. I mean, and I would say that that's within the last sort of few years where that I've noticed that change. So it's taken time to get to that point. And it's not like women are evenly represented by any means, but I think generally within the science or within geosciences, I think the statistics are is that it's typically about 70% men, 30% women. And within my area of geosciences, I think it was maybe 90% men and 10% women. And now we're sort of working our way up. So it's not evenly men and women, at least working our way up generally to be more sort of in line with the rest of geosciences, which is a good first step. You have to kind of start somewhere. And then in terms of funding, I think that is still a problem. I think that I think men in my field in particular just have to do less and they get more. So women are just held to a higher standard. I just feel like I have to work way more and publish way more, do way more to even get recognized as like the same level as my male colleagues. So that's really frustrating, and that's something I don't know how to fix. I mean, if you go directly to a program manager who's handing out money for funding and you say that to them, they get offended and they say, I'm doing my best to give funding to the people who are doing the best science, even though I think it's sort of an underlying bias and people don't like those biases necessarily getting pinned on them. So it's a delicate issue that I don't know how fix. And the last couple of days, it's funny the timing of this, the last couple of days there was this online meeting for snow hydrology, and it was like 200 people from all over the country attending, so a lot of people, and they were having experts in the field present on sort of the cutting edge technology, and all of them were men. All like there were 24 speaking slots, and there were 4 women like in the agenda, but none of them were like the field experts. And I was just like, this is the perfect example, because if you don't put women on the agenda as an expert, no one's gonna go to them later and ask them about those topics. And so that was I'd love to say that it's like not an issue anymore, but it definitely is.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess to that end too, would you say that, you know, you put out all these papers, all this research, do you feel that it is, you know, been appropriately recognized and appreciated now? Or do you still feel like if, you know, a male colleague could put out that same amount of work, would they be like,
they would probably
better regard?
Yeah, they would probably be cited more. And that's the currency of like what we do is how often, you know, people cite your research. And I think I don't want to say that because I have done research that's been well received and well cited. So I don't want to say that, like, oh, I never get cited. But what I will say is often what happens is that someone will cite a paper by my graduate advisor rather than citing a paper by me, even though mine is the more appropriate reference. So they'll be like similar topic areas, but instead of citing mine, which is more recent, they'll cite an older paper where he was the main author, and it has like nothing to do with him. If anyone asked him, he'd be like, yeah, you should cite that one, the more recent paper. But I think it's just like, it's sort of this bias in people's heads where they think men are the experts. And so they're going to cite a paper from that person. And then it's a self-feeding cycle, because then, oh, that paper is more cited, I'm going to cite the more cited paper. And I think other women in my field would say the same thing. That it's not that we never get cited, but it's that our male colleagues get.
There's one thing that really awesome response. My roommate Sophie is a PhD, and she's in her PhD program in research. And she attests to a lot of what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's funny because I know I'm not the only one, but it's always nice to hear other people's experiences and to know you're not the only one.
And then let's see. Yeah, I guess. So, I guess kind of related to, you know, women not being as like well represented and cited, and that could be discouraging. You know, do you think like more role models in the field would help people feel more validated in what they're doing? Do you think people and, you know, women see you as a role model, or do you have any specific ones in the field?
Yeah, I do. I do have, I mean, I had to kind of seek people out because within my, when at least in graduate school, my sort of immediate collaborator circle were colleagues of my graduate advisor, and there weren't many females in that. So when I started going to conferences or interacting with other sort of network of other colleagues, I sort of seek people out specifically. And that has been super helpful to have women in the field, and just sometimes it's just to like watch what they're doing and sort of, you know, how frequently they're publishing or how many graduate students they have, or just be able to send a quick email and be like, what do you think about this? It's like really helpful to have those people. And it's not, I don't even collaborate directly scientifically with some of them. They're more just like a friend and a resource. And then I think this is maybe not exactly going to answer your question, but I think something that can help in terms of like, see, having more women in like leadership roles or representation, as I mentioned, program managers. And one of the intimidating things about being a woman in science is that, and I think this is changing, but very frequently the people that sort of control the money and hand out research funding are men. And it can be intimidating as a woman to approach that person and like describe your research ideas. And often that is how, you know, having relationships with program managers is really helpful. And it can be, at least when I was starting out, it kind of felt like a boys club. Like the men in my field were funded and the program managers were males, and they would like hang out with each other at conferences. And it's just like really hard to break into that like sort of like boys club circle. And you know, some of that might have been my own insecurity or imposter syndrome. But also it's just like an intimidating dynamic, and so figuring out ways to break up that dynamic and make the people who are actually funding the research more available and less intimidating, I think is will play a huge role in just women not only like getting established in STEM fields in the first place, but then also just staying in it through their careers.
That makes sense. I guess also like going off of that, did you hear back about the election for your position?
I got it.
Nice, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's great.
Yeah, so that felt nice.
And I remember reading, you said there's like a year now that you'll spend working with the current president. Will you be able to like implement your ideas right away, or is it kind of like slower passing of the torch, and then next year you'll have more freedom to do what you'd like to do?
Yeah, it's a slow passing of the torch. So I'll work with the current president. And it's funny, speaking about like, you know, seeing women represented in the field, because the current president is a woman, and she is someone that I've worked with in the past, and have seen her in that role made me comfortable putting myself up for that role. So it's sort of a direct example of this. And so it's exciting to have this time where I kind of get to learn from her and, you know, understand the expectations of the role, but also understand sort of what actions I'm able to take. And then she also stays on. When I take on that role, she stays on for another year in sort of an advisory role. So you get lots of time to like learn, and then be supported when you move into that position to sort of implement your piece.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice. So this is let's see. Yeah, more about like I guess kind of the valley here, and kind of from the research you've done and everything you've read and seen, what would you say is probably the biggest contributing factor to the depletion of the Great Salt Lake?
Yeah, the Great Salt Lake water system is really unique, and it's not the only, system like this in the world. But what makes the Great Salt Lake system so unique is that it's so small. It's like really enclosed, and almost all of the water to sort of refill the Great Salt Lake every year comes from snow, and as the number of people have increased between like where the snow melt went off and where the Great Salt Lake is, less and less water has flown off into the lake over time because the people are using it. And that's part of the reason why we all live here is the sort of ready availability of surface water every year and the fact that that's able to support agriculture. And I think actually that even though the Great Salt Lake has been shrinking, there's enough water to meet everyone's needs. There's enough water to meet people's needs. There's enough water to meet agricultural needs. And there's enough water to let it actually run off and sort of restabilize lake levels. But the problem is that we're not very efficient at managing water right now, moving it around in an efficient way, actually recording how much there is, knowing exactly how much snow there is in the mountains. There's just like the easiest way to explain it is that it's like a leaky system. There's just not great and efficient water management. And so I think the main problem now is actually, sort of addressing water use and how we track water. And then better, just like there's known tools to know exactly how much water we have in the mountains, and that can include modeling or flying planes over to measure it. And very little work has actually been done on that side, even though the snow is the natural water reservoir and that's where all the water comes from. A lot of times they're trying to address symptoms of the Great Salt Lake, like increased evaporation or sort of these midstream water uses. But I think if we started at the source, got a good understanding of how much water we were starting with every year, then we can allocate it efficiently. And that's not how they've been thinking about addressing that problem, despite me speaking up as loudly as possible. So I think they might get there eventually because if you don't know how much water you're starting with, you don't know how to use that water efficiently.
And how would you gather that data? Because, all the resorts and stuff track snow totals throughout the year, and all that data is recorded. I know there's plenty of gauges along all the tributaries that lead into the Jordan. So what other methods do you use to more accurately track that?
Yeah, so a lot of the measurement sites we have, whether they're ski resorts or they're snow cells, these automated snow telemetry sites, all of those are located, or almost all of them that measure snow depth are located in the mid elevations. Once the snow melts above that elevation, we're blind to how much water is actually left up in the mountains. And you can look up, in late spring, early summer, and still see that there's a lot of snow left up in the mountains, but we don't actually know how much is there because it's melted out above the measurement stations. But there are, you can fly LIDAR, you can map the snow depth over an entire watershed rather than measuring it at like a single point. And that is expensive, but all you need to do is sort of a couple of flights to understand snow distributions, and then you can use that information to inform spatially distributed snow models. And it will, simulate snow buildup and melt out over the entire watershed every year, informed by those snow patterns. And a lot of people have shown that that is the most accurate way to know exactly how much water you're starting with, and that knowing that can make water use decisions downstream more efficient.
Okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense. And then I guess on an individual level, you know, what is something that we could do to help keep the Great Salt Lake from drying up? And, you know, are there ways that as an individual besides voting that you can, you know, help to alleviate this kind of leaky water system?
Actually, I think I never give the answer people expect of this, and I don't think there's much that individuals can do, because it is actually kind of a hard problem, because 80% of the water is going to agriculture. A very small fraction gets used for our personal water consumption. It's tiny. Even lawns, showers. I mean, of course, water conservation is never a bad idea, but it doesn't make a huge impact in terms of numbers for the Great Salt Lake. And we have sort of a bigger systematic change that would be needed in the way that our country approaches agriculture. Like a big change. And, you know, there's no, you don't ever, you know, farmers are just trying to make a living. And so it's not farmers' fault. It's the way that our country has sort of made this agricultural economy around different crops that really shouldn't be grown where they're grown. And so it's a challenging problem, but ultimately, I mean, people should do water conservation because it's just generally a good idea, but, you know, ultimately if we want to address sort of water issues here and in the broader West, there's bigger systematic problems that probably need to get addressed. And most of those relate to that.
Not farming alfalfa, no. High
not,
desert.
Not farming alfalfa.
And I guess, I know you're going to have a lot more responsibilities with this new role you're going to take on, but where do you kind of see your future research going? Is it going to go into kind of more accurate modeling of the Wasatch or something else? Like, what are you really excited to start next besides the new position?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of my lab's work, so a lot of my students' work right now is focused on more accurate modeling and improving the way that we can run those models and also where the data comes from for those models. And so we're really trying to come up with innovative ways to use remote sensing data from satellites. And then also to integrate like the LiDAR plane mapping that I mentioned, and also use the long-term measurements from the observation networks on the ground. So how do we integrate all of these sort of multi-scale measurements to come up with the best models that we can of our watersheds, and really focusing on the time period between when we hit peak snow water equivalent or peak snow depth and meltout, because that's the most critical time for water resource decision making. And so being able to provide accurate snow melt volumes and timing to people downstream to sort of, you know, we're not making the decisions, but if we can give them better information, maybe they can make better informed decisions and use water more efficiently.
Makes sense. Cool. Any other ones you wanted to ask?
So I just had a one follow-up question from last time too. It was like, talk about how you had to stand up for yourself to get on trips and to get your work recognized. Is there anything like, which I think is pretty impressive to, as a graduate student, to stand up, but is there anything like that you wish you stood up to people more, or that what other things like you know, like a level to get through it?
Yeah, you know, I think I did. I sort of selectively picked my battles.
Yeah.
And at this point in my career, when I'm a little more established and less afraid of people, I'm more willing to speak up and say something. Like this conference I mentioned, where they only have men speaker as the experts. I emailed the person who had organized that meeting. Told them that I thought we made a mistake by only having men on the agenda. And then I gave them examples of women that I could just speak about those same topics. And, you know, I think in the past I would have been worried, like, oh, this person is going to think that I'm, like, an old female for saying this. But if nobody ever says anything, then nothing's ever going to change. And so I wish that I had spoken up more, but in a way I also think that not speaking up sometimes did allow me to potentially have experiences I wouldn't have if I just always spoke up and always criticized people for not letting women and like be involved, you know. So it was sort of like playing the game a little bit and being a part of the culture and getting those chances and those experiences and like trying to be cool. I don't know. So like I feel like, you know, not speaking up allowed me to get some experiences and get more established. But now that I am established, I'm less afraid to say those things. Because now if I don't get a field experience because someone didn't invite me to, they're like, oh man, she's just like always talking about how women don't get opportunities in the field, then I can just go on and organize and play my own field campaign and make sure that people, you know, that everyone's represented and welcome and invited. And so when you don't have those resources, it can feel really risky to kind of step out of your comfort zone and say something. So there's many times when I didn't, just because I didn't want to risk, I guess maybe I hate that I think about this way now, but I hate being in the blank. Like I didn't want to be annoying. And so I wish that I'd been able to speak up, but at the same time, like if I had spoken up, I might not have gotten all the experiences.
I guess similar to that is like, obviously through currently and then looking back, like a lot of male groups and obviously nobody ever bats an eye at that. Do you think there would be, like, would you like to make an all-women's group and do you think that would have a positive impact or would end up on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think yes. Yeah, I would love to. And it's something I have thought about in the past and it's something that I think you need to have someone who's a champion and who like will really put in the time to making sure people feel welcome and supported and like someone to organize like meetings and to make sure it's like well organized, because the worst thing is if you have an idea and then you don't really have the time to follow through. And so I could foresee like really having the time and energy for something like that, maybe a few years down the road, which is like maybe I should just do it now. But yeah, I mean, I don't know of one that exists in my field, and I think it would be great if we did.
We watched a movie in class a few weeks ago called Picture Scientist. You should watch this again. But one of the people in it is this chemist, and she mentions how a lot of her time is spent, like, as a Black woman, feeling she has to spend a lot of time crafting and curating her emails and responses so that she's perceived in the light she needs to be perceived in. Have you had any similar experiences?
Yes. Like, yeah, of many emails that I send, I feel like sometimes I'll look back on it after I hit send, I'm like, I just spend 30 minutes writing this email, because, yeah, you have to go back and you're like, don't want to use too many exclamation points, so you don't want to, like, use the wrong, you don't want to be too colloquial, or, like, too, you know, it's just like, you, yeah, your tone is always, it's just, like, really important, and it's funny, because now I have a female postdoc, and she's just getting established in the field, and she says that she has like ChatGPT review her emails to make sure that they sound professional before she sends them out. And I was like, oh, maybe that would save time rather than just me staring at them. And like, this is so weird. So yeah, that's definitely something I still have always dealt with.
And then I do want to talk a little bit about your work with Protect Urban Cures, just because they're a pretty well-known organization in the last.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, I feel like it's particularly relevant over the last couple of days. an environmental nonprofit group started by a snowboarder who just like did not see. He was worried about climate. He just didn't see anyone else doing anything else to be sort of this advocate for not just protecting our rivers, like that's a nice pitch, but just more broadly protecting the environment. And the, you know, I really like the mission that they come up with is that, you know, it's not partisan. It's so many people enjoy the outdoors for so many different reasons. Let's bring together everybody who enjoys, they call it the outdoor state, bring together everyone who enjoys the outdoors, you know, come up with ways that we can protect the places that we love. And their main sort of way that they advertise is through athletes who are influencers. And I think it's effective because one time they put up this slide that showed the reach of all the influencers, and it was like millions of people or something. And then they use scientists, the science alliance, to make sure that their sort of athletes and influencers are informed and saying the right things. And then they also put up like the reach of all the scientists, and it was like, you know, we each had like 500 followers or something like that. So we don't have the same reach, but we can provide and support those people that do have huge audiences, make sure they're informed. They know, you know, they're not climate experts, but they want to make sure that they're saying the right things. And that if they sort of put themselves out there, that they know that they have sort of this team of scientists behind them that can help support them. And that is part of my role at Protect Our Futures, is just, you know, to support them. But then also we get to go to Washington, D.C. and advocate for different policies. And so I've been to D.C. with them. And then my role is we have to basically be there as the scientists that can talk about everyone else can kind of give their experience, and then we can say, well, the scientists are in this. It's sort of like just, it's easy, I think, for the athletes to not be taken seriously because someone will say, oh, you're not a scientist. But then they say, oh, well, but I have a scientist right here. yeah, so that's kind of my role with POW. And I think in this day and age where social media is so important, that they have a big impact based upon like the way that they go about advertising, reaching people.
Are there any other groups that you think that you work with or would like to work with that also have a bigger reach, that more influence?
Yeah, that's a good question. I work with a much smaller group, and it's a different focus, but it's called Community Snow Observations. That's kind of really specific to my field, but it's for backcountry skiers. That if you're out already, and you have an avalanche probe with you, you can just pull it out and like on your phone on an app sort of just record snow depths as you go along different spots. And you could do one or you could do 10, like depending on how much time you have and how much excitement you have for it. And that automatically populates on a map with like a timestamp. And in areas where there's lots of observation, it just allows us to understand snow distributions a little bit better. So that's kind of a cool sort of citizen science effort that I'm a part of, that I try to tell people about. So, and yeah, but there's really, I mean, I think just to fill a need for this, there's a lot of really great environmental nonprofit work going on, and everyone kind of has their own focus, but all sort of focused on protecting the environment, and all of that work is important and worthy, and hopefully people don't get too negative about it. It's sort of change of political climate, because that work still needs to get done, even if it's a little bit harder.
Have you ever considered like working with the ski clubs on campus with that citizen science project and having them encourage their members to take those readings?
Yeah, that's a great idea. I have not done that yet. But it's a great idea. We did last year, oh my gosh, it might be 2 years ago now. We did work with the ski club, so Jeremy Jones, the head of Protect Our Winters, came to University of Utah, and we did a showing of one of his films about like reaching across the political divide, and then did like a panel afterwards, and we advertised it with the ski clubs.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So yeah, that was great. But yeah, it helps if you're, you know, I don't know, actually this might be like my perception, but I don't know how many backcountry skiers are part of the ski clubs, because it helps to have an avalanche probe with you, like, set up measurements. And So maybe I just assumed it was, you know, student brain.
Right.
It probably was if it was like you talk for
students. Yeah.
I think that's about it. Joe?
I do have like one, I guess. And so obviously kind of the goal of this whole thing is like giving, you know, showing history like a view and just making sure that we are getting women's stories down for the records because they're continuously overlooked. Do you think for other questions, is there anything that you kind of wish you brought up that you could highlight and that we could bring awareness to or anything you want to?
Yeah, it's funny because after we talked last time, I did think of something, but now I'm not going to remember. Or it's like something I wish I had said during, but yeah.
And if it comes back to you at any point too, we can hop on a quick call and just take 5 minutes to address that.
Yeah, because it was like, oh, I wish I had told this story or something. I can remember. No, I don't think so. I mean, I guess just I love that you guys are doing this. I think it's a great project. And I think that ultimately, like if I were to sum up my experience, it would be generally very positive because I feel like I've been able to make change and to support other women in the field, but that there's still a lot of work to do, and that there's been hurdles, sort of there's still unique hurdles to women in science. And it would be great to sort of like reach a point where those didn't exist. I don't think that that's going to be a thing, but I remember now one of the things that I wanted to say is I think that the sort of the way that you're forced to be in as a woman in science, you get a little bit defensive of like you're like, oh, because you don't get recognized as much as you want, you sort of like try to advocate for yourself and talk about your work, and I think that kind of can pit women against each other sometimes, so where they're super competitive and even more competitive than they might be with their male colleagues. And I think that that is just the most unfortunate side effect of feeling like you don't belong, because you're sort of like proving to yourself that you belong, but in that you can become really competitive and, you know, feel like you're trying to prove yourself or like trying to force out other women. And I've had those interactions with women in my field where I feel like they're competing with me rather than supporting each other. And it makes me sad. And so I hope that, you know, like a benefit of just like feeling comfortable and equal with everyone is I think that would go away. So I think that that's an unfortunate side effect of sort of this like feeling like it's very competitive, where actually women, if they support each other, can be much sort of have this community of support and it be, yeah, just overall better experience. So I remember wanting to like how it's like you either meet someone in science, another woman in science, and you become best friends forever, or you meet a woman in science and you're like, why does she meet so much? So it's like there's not a lot of in between. And that I feel like it's just a product of how we're forced to like exist in science, and that is unfortunate. Yeah.
Do you feel like that's changed at all throughout your career? Like, hopefully more of the former is what's happening now.
I do think I actually have most of those interactions where I feel like I'm like being really competitive or they're like not supportive is like almost always now women who are more established than I am, and women who are like coming up into the field now, I feel like we have a much better community and just are kinder to each other and like supportive. We see each other at conferences, we hang out. I mean, that is like the kind of thing you want to feel supported and welcome and just like your science friends. Like that's much more fun. And so I do think it's changed. I think it's changed, and I hope that it continues to change.
Yes.
That's it. That was
great.
That was amazing. Thank you, Brad.
Yeah.
And then I guess this is the end of the recording.